For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
My name is Chris Risley. I'm a home group leader and a class teacher here at Xenos, and we are going to be talking today about how love can be polarizing. You know, every group of Christians is going to be made up of a whole composite of people. You're going to have leaders in the group. You're going to have your trusted workers in the group. Hopefully you'll have some brand new believers and some non-Christians that you're working with. But almost every group is going to have a couple of people or maybe a small pod of people who have really stalled out in their walks, who maybe were doing well at some time and hit some sort of block, or maybe they never really got excited about their walk with God in the first place. And so this talk today is going to be focusing specifically on how to help those people, how to move into their lives in a way that, Lord willing, is really transformative. Okay, so to start off with, a quote from Bruce Powers out of the book Christian Leadership. He says, "We're pursuing the same task pursued by Jesus, helping people become all that they can become under God." Or as it is said so beautifully in Ephesians 4:13, "Until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to the mature man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ." You know, almost everybody that we're working with, including yourselves, are going to go through tough times in their walks, and people are going to have setbacks. But what you'll see as you're trying to help people is that there will be some people where it gets too easy for them not to work through whatever issues are holding them back in their walk. And the next thing they know, they've really settled into kind of a mediocre Christian life, and they're not really doing anything that bad, but they're not doing anything that good either. You know, there are talks this weekend talking about, you know, how to admonish people. And there will be people that you're working with that have much more overt sin. Maybe they get really enmeshed in some sort of sexual sin, maybe it's some sort of drug use, or, you know, things that while they're not pleasant to deal with, they're really obvious and objective. And sometimes those situations can be a little bit easier to move towards because it's very clear cut what's wrong and how they're dealing with it. But there will be other situations where it's a little bit less obvious. You know something's wrong, but because it's not obvious what's wrong, it's harder to know how to move towards that person. And so that's what we're going to be spending our time here talking about today. In the book Organic Discipleship, they say, "No disciple is completely willing from the beginning and continues to go all out for God from then on. Most disciples encounter some sort of breakdown in their progress sooner or later. If you sense your disciple isn't making good progress, what's your move?" I mean, there's a lot of different tacks that you can take, a lot of different avenues that you can try. They say, you know, points of resistance are different than weaknesses, mainly when it comes to a person's will. A disciple with a weakness wants to change, but may have trouble doing so. Such disciples exert effort to change and are distressed when they fail. So that's actually a really good sign. As we have argued earlier, we should be extremely patient with weaknesses. A resistant disciple, though, is different. When a disciple becomes resistant, you will see signs that she's not on board with God's agenda for her life. Resistance is not just a matter of behavior, but more important, of attitude. And so part of what we're going to be talking about today is how to discern when a disciple or anybody that you're working with really becomes resistant, and how to work with them in such a way that you're actually trying to overcome some of that resistance so that they have a chance to walk with God. And so before we begin, I want to give you a quick outline just so you know where we're going with this. And you don't have to write these things down. I'm going to let you know these will be the numbers on the bottom of the PowerPoint if you like taking notes. I like taking notes, so I like things to be organized. So the first thing we're going to do is just give a definition of what polarization is. We'll also be talking about some important considerations as you try to decide if this person even needs to be polarized or not. Some blocks that you personally might run into as you're working with people who are in a situation. Practical issues to address, as well as practical steps to take. And then also how to strike the right tone in the conversation that you need to have with people that you're working with. You know, what got us thinking about this, my husband and I lead not just a home church, but we also oversee several home churches. And there were several of those home churches that had actual sizable pods of people who were kind of stuck. And we were telling them, you really have to work with these people and polarize them. And 9 months later, the majority of those people were gone. And we thought, is that a success? I wouldn't say that that's actually what we were trying to do here. And it made us realize how hard this is to do, to work with people who are kind of stuck and aren't sure how to move forward. So this talk is a result of a lot of conversations that we've had with a lot of leaders over the past couple of years. So to start with, a definition of what polarization is, it's ongoing conversations with a person you fear is heading in the wrong direction spiritually. You're noticing that they're losing their excitement about following God. It is possible that they're enmeshed in a more subtle sin issue that could take them out completely. But again, this is the person who is not just in some sin that they're in high-handed defiance against God, but they're just kind of stuck. And of course, we know that you can't just not grow, that that's not how life works, that you're either growing or dying. And so when you see somebody stop growing with God, you have to get kind of concerned about what direction their spiritual life is actually going to head. And the goal is to win them into full commitment to God's good plan for them. We have all the promises of the Bible, and we know why it is that we're following God. We know the good things that He has for us, and we're trying to help them become convinced that those things are available for them as well, and that it's worth any price that they need to pay, any sacrifice that they need to make, in order to tap into that more abundant Christian life that God promises to everybody. But just as important as knowing what it is, it's also important to know what it's not. And so polarization is not getting nitpicky with someone who's actually doing pretty well and heading in the right direction. That's part of what you're trying to see, is what's the general trajectory for this person. Everybody that you're going to work with has issues. And we should always be praying about how to help our people, our disciples, our coworkers in the Lord, everybody that's in your life. You should be praying about how to help them get to the next level, how to work on whatever it is that God's bringing up in their lives. But it turns out that everyone has issues, and that includes you. You also have issues. There are problems in your life, and God is very patient with you. He's very patient with all of us in that He doesn't bring everything up at once. And thank God for that. And so you might be working with somebody that has a lot of issues, but they're headed in the right direction because God's not changing everything all at once. Polarization is also not getting the annoying person to go away. There will be people that God brings into your life that just really rub you the wrong way. Perhaps they're just really rough around the edges because of any problems that they come into your group with. Perhaps they really annoy you because they remind you a little bit too much of you. And it would be a lot easier if you just didn't have to deal with them and their issues. But just getting them to go away is not the point of this talk. Healthy home churches, healthy churches in general, should be able to win a good number of people over into exciting walks with the Lord. You know, sometimes as you're bringing stuff up, the person will just want to transfer to another group. Well, it turns out their problems follow them. And so you really want to try to help them work out as much stuff as possible. And that's not to say that we're going to be able to win everybody. People are free will creatures. And I'm grateful for the fact that we're working with adults because they're responsible for their own decisions. And I'm also not saying that if you do a good job with this, that you will be successful all the time. What I am saying is that if you learn how to bring up the right issues in the right time, you'll be more successful winning people than groups that are either too harsh and impatient with people on their issues, or groups that are too slow and too soft as they're working with people. And so we want to be patient, loving people who are moving powerfully into people's lives. It's also not nagging someone to death. We are not their parents. We are not responsible for making sure that they're living according to certain standards. They are going to make their choices, and we're going to learn how to bring things up in such a way that's gentle and kind while still being truthful. So we're not just driving people away from us, but we're really trying to work with them successfully. So after our definition, it's important to consider different factors as you're trying to decide how to work with someone. And the first consideration is, should this person even be polarized? How old are they in the Lord? You know, if someone's in your group who's 2, 3, 4 months old in the Lord, you're not going to be sitting down with them and asking them to make their second decision to commit their entire life to God, because they don't even know what that means. And any decision that they make before they're equipped, before you're teaching them what the truths of the Bible are, those decisions are going to be made out of emotion and not out of understanding. It takes time to build convictions I mean, consider, where were you when you first started following God? It's embarrassing to admit, but 6 months old in the Lord, I was living in one of the Christian rooming houses that we have at Xenos. We call them ministry houses. And as a six-month-old Christian, I was sneaking out of the ministry house to try to go hook up with my ex. Not good, but I came in with a lot of baggage, and it just takes time to work stuff out. And God was very patient with me. So, you know, you need to consider what it is that this person understands and what they're accountable to. Another consideration is, do you even have a vision for this person? Can you picture what they would become if they were trusting God with their lives? And the more specific the vision is, the more you're going to be able to win them over to that vision. And, you know, the vision can't be, well, I just want to stop them from being such a punk. That's not a vision for the person. That's just you being annoyed with them. You want to really get before the Lord, and this will come up a little bit later too, but ask the Lord to show you what they could be like as he transforms them. And this vision is based in God's promises. It's just so helpful to be reading through the Word and to see he picks the most unlikely people to use in his plan so that the glory really goes to him and not to us. Now, if you're reading Acts 8, you're not thinking in the back of your mind, I bet you Saul is going to become the most powerful Christian worker that ever lived on this earth. And even in Acts 9, you know, Jesus meets him on the road to Damascus. He's lying in a bedroom in Damascus, and God goes to Ananias, and he's like, all right, go lay hands on Saul and tell him that how much he needs to suffer for my name. And Ananias is like, Lord, I think you said the wrong name. And the Lord's like, no, I know who I'm talking about, but thanks for your advice. You know, so we really are not going to be able to decide ahead of time who God gets to pick to use in really powerful ways. And on the one hand, discernment, very, very valuable. I think it's something that we can learn. It's something that we can work on with other people. But if you had given me a list over the years and told me to pick out the people that right from the very beginning I could tell that that person was going to be used very powerfully by God, I would not be right a large percentage of the time. Some people that I thought were going to be awesome, they totally faded. Other people, I'm like, I don't know if they're ever going to do anything. They're really powerful leaders for God. And so God is faithful. You think about his promise in 2 Peter 1:3 that it's his divine power that has granted us everything necessary for life and godliness. The Holy Spirit loves to get into people's lives and change them. Or you think about 1 Corinthians 1:9, where Paul says, God is faithful, through whom you were called into fellowship with his Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. And one thing that's really helpful about that verse for me is it's written to the Corinthians. He writes this. This is the beginning of the letter where he's like, I thank God for you, and I think about how faithful God is to you. And could you stop fighting with each other? And could you stop that guy from having sex with his stepmom? And could you stop getting drunk at communion? You know, like, these were pretty major problems that the Corinthian church had. And yet Paul is like, I am so thankful for you, and I am trusting that God is working in your lives. I mean, do you really believe that it's possible for God to change this person? And if you believe that, it's going to affect how you move towards them. You also have to consider, how important is the issue? I would argue the more closely related it is to the means of growth, the more crucial it is. Or the more destructive it is to people's relationships with each other. You know, I've worked with girls over the years that just have the most out there issues. And I think, man, that is a real problem. And then you know what happens? The Lord grows their ministry. And I realize, I guess that issue wasn't as key to the Lord as it seemed to me. And so you have to really look at what is the heart of the Bible. What is it that God calls us to in terms of Christian maturity? And people will have problems. You know, we're all a little weird. So God loves to use people like that. And part of what you're trying to figure out is, are they even, you know, what's the heart attitude behind what they're attempting? The real question is, are they trying? And I would argue, if someone is trying, that you can exercise a ton of patience with whatever they're struggling with. You know, if someone doesn't want to try in their spiritual lives to get in there and exhort them and try to work with them, it's not that different than using a cattle prod. You can get in there, you kind of jolt them, and they'll move forward a couple of spaces, and then they'll settle back into their plodding walks where they're not really doing anything. And you'll find that over the years, you can jolt them again, and they'll move, and then they'll settle back down. You think about the New Testament, what it talks about is trying, striving, straining. These are attitudes that you're trying to discern. And again, what we're talking about is not the person who just came to Christ or just started walking. This is a person who you've been working with for the past 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and they're not really progressing, and they seem perfectly content with where they're at. It just doesn't match the New Testament picture of a maturing Christian. You think about what Paul says in Colossians 1:29, "For this purpose also I labor, striving according to his power." You just sense Paul with every ounce of his being trying to cooperate with God's purposes. Or you think about Hebrews 12:4. "You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood, and you're striving against sin." Being mediocre is just not part of the New Testament picture. So these are the things you need to be thinking about on a regular basis with the people that you're working with. Questions that you're trying to answer, because we're always trying to discern, are the people that we're trying to shepherd and help, are they moving in the right direction or not, in general? But you'll also run into some blocks as you're trying to move towards people, especially in a confusing situation like this. And so some possible blocks. One would be fear of upsetting the person. You know, this is not a comfortable thing to do, to get in there and try to stir things up a little bit, to get them a little bit less content with where they're at. And a lot of times, because these people have been around for a long time, sometimes it's people who have been a good friend to you over the years, or maybe you went through something really intense with them in the past, and now all of a sudden here you are, and they're stuck and you need to help them. In general, whenever you're moving in to point things out to somebody, it's entirely possible that they're not going to respond well, even short term, but long term too. You know, people will get upset as you're trying to do this. Another possible block is that it does take a lot of emotional energy to try to help somebody that's stuck. And there are times when my flesh questions, is this really going to be worth it? You know, wouldn't it just be easier if we didn't have to help people? Wouldn't it be easier if we didn't have to serve or sacrifice in any way? And my flesh is always trying to pull me back towards, it's just a little bit more comfortable not to mix it up with this person. And I really have to get before the Lord and remind myself that it will be worth it. And it will cost me energy in the short term, but long term, if I can win them over, then they'll be a co-laborer with me, which will be helpful. There's also the fear, what if it doesn't work? What if I try to help them and they remain in the same position as before? I really like the book Difficult Conversations in general, but I've got some quotes from this book in this talk. And they say in the beginning, for every case that is truly hopeless, there are 1,000 that appear hopeless, but are not. And how true is that? That we're just not going to know how the person's going to respond until we get in there and try. And no matter how badly it goes, it's still going to be better to try and have it not go well at first than to not try at all. And there are a lot of cases that I can point to where I thought, I don't know if this is even going to work. And God's like, you can't predict ahead of time how people are going to respond to me. Don't even try, because sometimes I'm doing things that you would never be able to guess. So there's those fears. Sometimes you'll run into guilt too, though. Partially guilt because you haven't addressed it sooner, and you kind of know, I sort of knew that this was a problem, and I could have brought it up, and I didn't. And so then you start thinking, well, can I really bring it up now? Maybe I missed my chance. Which the problem with that is, one, part of that is accusation from the evil one, because he doesn't want you bringing it up, because he wants that person continuing to be unaware or enslaved to their mediocrity. But part of it is also self-focus, like, oh, I messed up. Well, yeah. Are you going to keep making the same mistake going forward? How about you just make it right by moving towards this person now? Or it could be personal guilt over your own issues, over your own struggles in this area. In the book No Little People, Francis Schaeffer talks about how King David did truly repent of his sexual sin, but then that sin destroyed his family. And it's probably because David never really moved into his sons' lives in that area. And You know, he really was a failure as a father. And you can kind of trace it back to his sin with Bathsheba. I find it to be a persuasive argument. And you know, what's interesting about that is you will even find that some of your guilt will actually get worked out as you're moving into the lives of other people to try to help them. You wonder, and I, you know, we'll only know when we get to heaven, this will be one of the questions that I ask when I get up there, but you wonder if David would have seen even more healing for his major fall if he had moved towards his sons in really powerful ways. So to get enmeshed in guilt is really self-focus. It becomes about you and not about the other person. And as Christian workers, we know that we're happier when we're trying to help other people than when we're all focused on ourselves. So those are some possible blocks that you'll run into. And then I thought it would be practical to talk about a list of issues that you could go after. That again, some of these are more subtle or hidden. So how do we know what issues we should go after with the long-term passive person? Well, one thing to explore is, are they participating in the means of growth? You know, our people should be working towards time with God most days of the week. And this is often overlooked. As I've been talking with leaders who have somebody who seems really stuck, they send them in for counseling, they talk a lot about their family stuff, they're setting all these goals with them, they're trying to get them to serve, and then I ask, well, how's their time with God? And you can see the discipler kind of blank, and you realize that they're kind of taking it for granted that that time with God is established and it's really good, and it might not be. And so you want to find ways to ask about it, and you want to try to get specific because, you know, I've asked people, how's your time with God? And they're like, oh, it's good. Or, here's another thing you should listen for, how's your time with God? It's a lot better. Better than what? So you want to try to ask specific questions about quantity, because they're like, oh, it's good. Well, what does good mean? Like, how many times this past week? Because if they say twice, that's a very different picture than five times. You know, twice a week, they're trying to live on a starvation diet spiritually. And you also want to ask about quality, because it is possible for people to get time with God and yet never learn how to connect with Him personally. You know, they'll check it off their list, but they never hear from God. They're never honest with God in their prayer time about what they're thinking and feeling. You also want to see, are they doing anything to try to serve anyone? Because otherwise, they're just that dead sea, and God's like, I can't pour anything more into you because it's not going back out. And so getting in there and trying to help them start practicing the means of growth, I mean, that's the whole point of Dennis's workshop, Love Therapy, is that the Christian community in the West really thinks we're here to receive blessings, but the truth is we're happiest when we're giving out. And people forget that all the time. And so that's one of our goals, is to get somebody serving in any way possible. You also need to get in there and ask about pornography. This is something that can be very hidden because it's very shameful for people, and people can struggle with addiction. And something that's really changed over the past decade is this is almost as common, if not as common, for women as it is for men. Back when I was in the ministry house, it was not a thing, although we all struggled with things like romance novels with very explicit scenes in it and chat rooms and all sorts of stuff like that. So it was still there. But women, if anything, feel even more shameful about it because that was never a thing for women before. And so we need to get in there and try to help people with that and at least get it out into the light and see if they're willing to get help for it. Something like excessive screen time can be a major barrier for people spiritually. I don't know about you guys, but I just am not capable of staring at a screen for an hour, turning it off, and then immediately turning and engaging with God or engaging with another person. You know, my brain is just a little bit foggy, and it takes a little while for me to be able to emotionally engage. And so if you've got somebody who's just spending hours on their computer or in front of the TV or on their phone, that's something that they're going to need help with. Especially as people get older, you have the struggle with personal peace and affluence. You know, materialism, you can't love God and money. And in the culture that we're in, how do you know if you struggle with materialism? Well, you live here. So the question is not, do you struggle with it, but how's that struggle going? And are you even battling against it? You know, the person who's always got the latest gadget, the person who seems to know all the latest everything, they might be struggling with materialism. You'll also see this as people start to transition from singlehood into married life into having kids, is it gets harder and harder to get out of the house. And the pull is just going to be towards going home and staying home and not having anybody else over, because that's way more comfortable. And so these are hard things, because like with screen time or with personal peace and affluence, there are times you're going to be at home. There's times when you're going to buy things, but you're kind of trying to gauge, is this becoming a barrier in their spiritual life? You also want to watch for extreme autonomy. I'm grateful for the fact that we've got ministry houses here, because that's a place where you almost have to engage. It's possible in the ministry house to not engage anybody, but that's kind of the focus of those houses. But you also want to watch to see how people are at meetings. You know, are they showing up and just kind of floating around the edges and not really getting involved in any deep conversations with anybody? You want to look to see, are they taking any ownership of the group at all? Do they seem to think about anybody else? Are they caring about anybody else? That could be a sign of autonomy, that they just kind of want to do their own thing and they don't want anybody infringing on their thought life, their space, their emotional energy. You want to see, too, if they're trying to serve anyone. Again, that's such a key feature. There will be people who just refuse to serve in your group. They're only there to take. Someone who struggles with an ongoing victim mentality and just rampant selfishness. They always want everybody to be helping them and pouring into them and talking about their issues. What's challenging about this is not only can this person become a real drain on people because they've never learned to serve and they just always seem to have some crisis, but if you get enough of these people in your group together, they can actually keep the group from accomplishing its mission. Yes, we are here to be good shepherds. Yes, we are here to take care of the sheep, but we are also here to win the lost. We are not a hospital, we are an army. And part of the reason that we advocate for that is because we know people are actually going to be happier if they're out trying to accomplish God's mission for the world. And then the final one that we thought about, this list is not exhaustive, by the way, but we just felt these covered some of the broader categories, is instability. This could be emotional instability. You know, the person who's just always crashing or always has some sort of anger problem. You know, they're up and down all the time, and you just are not quite sure when you can put weight on the relationship, because they could, you know, lose it at some point. But you'll also see people in your group who are there for a little while, and when they're there, they seem like things are headed in the right direction, and they're actually gaining some traction, and then they disappear for a period of time, and you're not even sure where they went. And then they float back into your group, and they seem to be getting reconnected with people, and then they disappear again. It's like, how far is that relationship going to go? Because you know, at any point, this person could disappear again. And so instability can be a major barrier in getting close to people. And one of the main ways of getting close to God is getting close to his family. So these are some of the things that if people are stuck in these, we need to address. And the reason we need to address these is because all of these are spiritual killers eventually. These are things that take people out and keep them from experiencing what God has for them. And so as you identify issues, it's also time to take some steps to actually move towards people. But of course, before you even have the conversation, the first thing you want to do is seek counsel. Talk to other people who you really trust to get their perspective on how this person is doing. Especially if you're trying to discern if someone's trying, that's a really difficult thing to discern. And so you want as many opinions as possible of people you trust to see if you have the right gauge on this or not. You know, I always, I am married, so I am not in one of our ministry houses. I want to know how my girl is doing with the other girl she's living with. Because maybe she's great at meetings, but she's a terror around the house. Or maybe she's great with me. I've had that in the past, where in my one-on-one time in my studies with a girl, she's awesome, but then nobody else feels like they even see her. And it turns out she's just trying to please me, and that's her main motivation in her walk. And so finding out what they're like with their roommates, and of course, if they're married, you want to know what their marriage is like, because their spouse is their roommate. And so it doesn't matter how good they are at meetings, if they are really difficult to live with at home, or if they're completely absent and disengaged at home, then we have a problem. And part of the reason, too, that I want to seek counsel is I'm not going to totally trust my read on the person that I'm working with. I could either be too positive, because I'm the one that's in there, I'm really emotionally invested in this person, I'm the one really pulling for them, maybe more than anybody else, because this is my girl that I'm responsible for, or maybe I'm too negative, because I've been in there trying to work on this issue with them, and I'm starting to get a little frustrated. And so I want to talk to people who are a little bit further back, who are a little bit less emotionally invested, to make sure that my read is correct. And there have been times where I feel pretty sure that I know exactly what's going on, and then everybody else that I trust has a different read. And so then, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to go with that other read. Especially if I'm trying to point out what I'm seeing and they're continuing to disagree with me, I have to trust that other people are going to see this more clearly than I do, because again, they're a little bit further back and they can get a little bit wider lens on the problem. So seek counsel. It's also helpful to anchor your points in scripture whenever possible as you're getting ready to talk to the person. Partly so that you can ensure that you're actually bringing up biblically important issues, but you also think about Hebrews 4:12. Where it says, the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword and piercing as far as the division of soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. I can say all that I want, but my words are not capable of piercing to someone's very heart and getting at their thoughts and intentions. And so there have been many times when I'm talking with somebody and I'm trying to help them with something, or I'm trying to point something out, and I'm like, I don't know, just go pray about it, here's a verse. And they leave, and they come back, and either the verse that I gave them or some other passage in scripture really spoke to them. Now, what's frustrating about that is, it means that I don't get the credit for them understanding the issue. But you know, they get it. Or what's even worse is when you're trying to bring something up with somebody, and you've been bringing it up for a while, and then they come out of a teaching by the preacher and they're like, did you know? And you're like, if only someone had brought that up before. But you know, that's the power of the word to work with people. You also want to be transparent as you're talking with the person that you're trying to work with. And part of that means being willing to express your emotions to them properly in a loving way. It's not like you're gonna go off on them. But out of difficult conversations, they say feelings are too powerful to remain peacefully bottled. They will be heard one way or another, whether in leaks or bursts. And if handled indirectly or without honesty, they contaminate communication. Research has shown that people can't tell if you are lying to them factually, but they can tell, like 95% of the time, if your words don't match your emotions. And so too often, I think we step back from these situations and think, well, I just need to be very logical and point out the points when I'm actually very sad or very frustrated. And if I could just say that, then they're going to be picking up on it anyway. And so I might as well describe to them what it is that I'm feeling. Because part of the problem, too, is if I'm feeling really sad or really frustrated, they're going to notice that, but they're probably not going to understand why I'm feeling that. And so they're probably going to wrongly attribute it to me, you know, being angry at them, or, you know, being really cold with them or something like that, when the truth is I'm actually just really sad. You know, I had a situation a number of years ago where I was trying to help a leader in my group. She was really excited about the fact that she was picked to be one of the workers at a summer camp that we do for our high school students. And so she was looking forward to going to this camp as a worker. And she was also really excited about the fact that a couple of her girls in her high school group, a couple of her disciples, were going to get to go with her. And then it turns out that like a month before everybody was supposed to head to camp, one of her disciples got busted out on kind of a subtle sin issue, but it was really problematic. And what was especially problematic was it tended to take other people out. And we were like, this girl can't go to the camp with you. You can't take her. And so I was talking to the leader, and we were talking through points that she could make and how she could let this girl know that she wasn't allowed to go to the camp. And I was like, well, how are you feeling? And she's like, I am just so disappointed, because I was excited not just that I got to go to the camp, but that I got to go with one of my girls. And now she won't even be there, and I am just really bummed out. It kind of taints the whole experience for me, because that was one of the things I was most excited about. And I said, you need to tell her that. And I think that's going to break through more than almost anything else that you could possibly say. So being honest about how we're feeling in a way that's really appropriate, it can also be helpful to narrate your thoughts sometimes with people. I've had situations where I've had to have conversations with people and I think, this is not very pleasant. Sometimes it's people who've come into my group from other groups, and I realize, oh, really quickly in this whole situation, I'm going to have to sit down with them and bring something up. I know, based on what the leaders in that other group are telling me, that this has not been sufficiently addressed yet, and now we're going to have to be pretty straightforward pretty early on in our relationship. And so you know what I've done? I've said that. I've said, I feel really bad about the fact that we're sitting down having this conversation already, and I wish it didn't have to be like that, but I care about you enough to bring this up, and I really want to help you with this. So will you let me share with you some of the things that I've been noticing? And again, those girls were going to notice that I was nervous anyway, so I might as well just tell them how I'm feeling. It really surprisingly diffuses the entire situation. So transparency can be really helpful. It's also helpful to focus on why we do what we do, rather than just what we do. You know, I had an experience at one point where we had a girl who was coming out to our meetings pretty consistently. She was moving in the right direction really well, and then she just totally stopped coming to everything. And then we have a weekend once a year where we invite our upper class high school students to come and check out our college group, spend the night at the ministry house, go to a lot of the meetings. And wouldn't you know, this girl who had totally disappeared, she shows back up. Why? Because she wants to spend the weekend doing all the really fun activities. And instead of saying, you're not allowed to do that, what we said was, College Connection is for people who are workers in our church and high school students that we're trying to win into the college group, and you're not really either of those things anymore. You used to be a worker in our group. What happened? And it was just a much more relational way of approaching the issue as opposed to telling her, you can't come to this weekend. And it really led to a good conversation about how she was doing. This specific example, unfortunately, was not successful. She eventually just faded right back out. But it was just different than telling her, no, you're not allowed. And so that can be something that can be helpful. Blank is for blank. So you're getting at the reason why we do things and letting people know that they're not at a level that they want to be at. And so things like, you know, discipleship is for somebody who really wants to be equipped to learn how to disciple other people. It's not for someone whose walk hinges on whether or not they meet with me every week. And so how can we get you to the point where you're actually interested in learning how to study so that you are equipped? Or things like some of the classes that we offer. They have a higher level of commitment. And so, you know, our leadership training class is for people who want in-depth training, not for people who feel like they have to go because their leaders expect them to. You know, our ministry house is for people who are trying to grow in their relationship with God and others. And you're not trying to do either of those things right now, so moving into the house is not going to help you with that. Again, how do we get you to that point? And so it's not the structure itself that becomes the barrier, it's where they're at in their walks with God because of the underlying reasons that we have these structures in the first place. And part of the problem is, if you're not explaining the underlying reasons for some of the boundaries that they have, they're going to think that standards are legalistic. You know, anybody should be allowed to do anything that they want, and you're telling me that I'm not allowed to. And I'm saying, it's not that you're not allowed to, it's that these structures are available for people who want to take advantage of them, and you kind of want to be able to do your own thing and yet get some of the benefits of higher levels of commitment, and that's just not going to be good for anybody involved. This also keeps us from getting too subjective as we're talking to people. You know, focusing on why we do what we do, it's a little bit too easy to get in there and be asking people to like repent from the heart on things. But instead, if you're talking about what it is that they want to do and explaining what's available to them as they really become committed workers for God, that gives them a vision and it gets them excited about making the sacrifices that are necessary. So focusing on why we do what we do, also bringing it up regularly and gently. So you see an issue in a person's life, addressing it, maybe not every week, but at least on a regular basis, even just asking about it can be sufficient. Think about 1 Kings 1:5 talking about Adonijah, it says, his father, King David, had never disciplined him at any time, even by asking, why are you doing that? And so there can be times when that's enough to bring it up with somebody. Why are you doing that? Why don't you come to our prayer meeting? I never really see you there. You're not confronting them on it, but you're letting them know that you notice. It's also avoiding what's called the leave it zap idea. This is from the book 1 Minute Manager, where you just ignore, and then you blast the person because you're just so frustrated with the fact that they're not doing anything. They also call it the seagull form of managing, where you, as a leader, are hovering at a high level, and then you swoop down, you crap all over the person, and then you swoop back out. It turns out that's not effective. So trying to bring things up in such a way that it's timely and it's not exceeding your relational capital. You don't want to go in too strongly if you haven't brought it up already. And so bringing it up regularly and gently, I do have a word of caution on that, and that is that you need to watch how you say things. Specifically, don't overstate your case. You know, in the book Difficult Conversations, they point out no one is always anything. You will learn this when you get married. Or if you're married already, you know this. The words always and never are never helpful. That's the only time I ever use the word never, saying never use always or never. So it's just never black and white with people. Rarely are you going to have someone who's just always bad. And so you want to make sure that you're not making it sound worse than it is, because that's going to make them defensive. You also should not attack personally. Try to avoid going after character stuff unless you can bring it up in a way that's appropriate. Try to stay focused on objective behaviors. And related to that, you need to choose the right words. You know, talking to someone about teaching to a group, saying your teaching was weak is different than your teaching sucked. I mean, which one's going to be easier to hear? You're a liar versus you were not honest with me. You know, that's two different ways of saying the same thing, but with one, their defenses are immediately going to go up, and they're going to know, I have to prove that this person's wrong, because if they're right, then I'm just a terrible person. Versus, you are a good person that I respect because you are made in God's image and you struggle in this area. So choose the right words, which maybe not all of you guys struggle with this, but related to that too, avoid using profanity when talking to people. That's unnecessarily inflammatory. I may or may not be speaking from personal experience. Just picture that if your talk was ever reported to the elders, how that would sound. And watch how you talk about them when they're not around. If you're really complaining about them or talking negatively about them when they're not around, that's going to affect your tone when you're with them. So your general demeanor is going to be affected by the words that you choose, and vice versa. So bringing it up regularly and gently, you know, with somebody struggling with, say, their word time, every week I'm going to ask, how's it going? How many times did you get into the word this week? Did you enjoy it? And if they're saying, oh, it was twice a week, I'll be like, great, twice a week. How can we get it up to 3 or 4 times this next week? Or they'll say, I didn't get into the word at all this week. I'll be like, okay, well, what happened? What can we try different this next week? Try to work things out. And then every 2 or 3 weeks, if they're not making any progress, I'm saying something like, it seems like we're not making a lot of progress, and I'm worried where this is going to head. And when you're in the word, you're way more engaged. I'm trying to be as gentle as possible because the regularity of the issue is actually going to be what brings the tension, as opposed to my tone. Although there have been times where we've been working for a couple months and they're still not making any progress, and then maybe I do get a little bit more intense. Like, seriously, I'm really, really worried about this. And of course, you're going to expect progress and setbacks as you're bringing stuff up with people. And going back to the original considerations, what's the overall progress? So bringing it up regularly and gently. You also want to watch for patterns that masquerade as problems. Cloud's book, Boundary for Leaders, talks about this, that if something happens once or twice, you have a problem. If it starts happening over and over and over again, you actually have a pattern and a pattern is different. Because if it's just a one-time problem, then there's explanations and maybe there's extenuating circumstances. But after it happens several times, the problem itself is actually just a symptom of deeper issues. Now, working with students in college, sometimes a pattern will be, wow, you'll do really well until about the 10th week of every single semester, at which point you'll totally freak out and withdraw from fellowship for 3 weeks because you're trying to get your grades back up. And so the first time that happens, you try to figure out their study patterns. Second time that happens, okay, this has happened before. By the third time that happens, you have a pattern. And it doesn't matter how often you try to help with the problem, if it's actually a pattern, there's other issues that have to be addressed. And so it can be helpful to point out the pattern. This happened with a girl of mine where she struggled with a history of instability and inconsistency. She'd be on a really good trajectory until she would totally lose it. And so I went back through old journal entries going back 3-4 years and pulled out the pattern and looked, okay, there was this time and there was this time and there was this time. And I sat down and I went through the pattern with her. And it broke through in a way that addressing each individual problem never did, because it kind of pulled her into the reality of, this is really serious. You can't pretend that you're just going to get better after every time that this happens. Now, you don't want to get too specific as you're bringing up the pattern. If you sit down with the list and you're like, now on March 11th of 2003, you know, that's just going to sound weird. And if you're that consistent, it kind of sounds like a weird job review or something. So you don't want to go there. But it can be helpful to be like, there was this good stuff, and then this happened. And then it seemed like things were getting better, and then this happened. And I've seen this work with people. You know, maybe you're working with somebody who has gotten to the point where they're capable of teaching, but they've had several teachings in a row, or maybe it's every other teaching. That's what my pattern was like in the beginning, that I would have one teaching that was really strong, and then I would think, wow, I'm a really good teacher. And so then I wouldn't prep for the next teaching, and it would suck. And then I'm like, oh man, that was really bad. And so I'd prep a lot for the next teaching, and it would be really good. And then I'm like, oh, I'm a really good teacher. And so then I wouldn't, you know, just up and down, up and down, up and down. And so sitting down with somebody to say, it's not just that this teaching was weak, but several of your past teachings have been weak, and you haven't asked for help. What is going on here? Now, zooming out and looking at the bigger picture can help them see that there is something going on. And again, you're just trying to draw them into the reality of the situation. And then finally, under practical steps, getting other people to weigh in with this person is really, really helpful, and one that we overlooked for years in our ministry. It gets you into a weird parent vibe, where other people in the group will come and tell you what's wrong with the person that you're studying with, and you'll be like, okay, I'll go and talk to them. Which one puts you in the awkward position of now you're the secondhand source. Oh, I heard you did this thing. And then if they have an explanation for it, you're like, now I'm confronting you on something that I didn't even see, so I don't know if your explanation is right or theirs is right. But it's a parent vibe, because essentially what the people in your group are doing is tattling on the person that you're working with, and you're like, well, I'll go talk to them. If you want every member ministry in your group, everybody should be trying to help everybody. And so if you're studying with someone or working with someone, and someone comes and tells you, I've noticed that they've done this thing, send them back. It also helps because maybe you're trying to bring up an issue with your guy or girl, and they're like, yeah, and they're just tuning you out. Well, it's easy for them to ignore you, but can they ignore two people? Can they ignore three people? Can they ignore four people? If multiple people are pointing it out, it's a lot harder to rationalize, and it gets everybody taking responsibility for each other. That's what every member ministry is we're all here to help each other. It's the entire body of Christ building each other up, and not just the leaders doing all of the work. So those are some practical steps, but just as important as the steps are, I do think it's very important to have the right tone in these conversations. And how do we go about having the right tone? Well, one, we need to pray and ask God for the right emotions. If we are not feeling really sad for where this person's at, feeling very worried about them, maybe feeling a little bit of righteous indignation over the fact that they're stuck, if we're just feeling detached, we're not going to be able to move in and talk to them with any persuasion, because they're going to sense that we really don't care that much. And so we need to ask God to awaken our hearts so that they can tell we're in there with them on this. We also need to thank God for the person. Any sense that you have that you really just don't care about him, gratitude will fix that. And again, if Paul was able to be grateful for the Corinthians, you can be grateful for the people that you are working with. Praying for a positive vision, asking for other people's help on this, going back to descriptions of mature Christians in the Word, asking God to give you a prayerful imagination as to what this person could be like. Also, a certain amount of humility will help you strike the right tone. Ask God to show you where you have struggled in similar ways. And perhaps the presenting issue is not the same, but the underlying issues could be identical. You know, I've worked with many girls over the years who have struggled with inconsistency and instability. And instability is not my thing. I'm a very stable person, personality-wise. I am eating the same things, doing the same things, wearing the same things that I was like 5 years ago. It's just how I am. You see me 5 years from now, I will probably be doing and eating and wearing the same things. That's my life. And so I could go in to talk to an unstable person and be like, well, I'm stable and you're unstable, so you should stop being like that. Not that helpful. It turns out that a lot of instability in the girls that I've been working with is driven by fear, and fear is one of the major issues that I do struggle with. It comes out in anxiety. It comes out in shutting down, withdrawing, trying to get control of everything. And so I can relate to that. And so finding ways that I can relate to their issues means that I'm not coming down and just preaching from on high on how they need to change, but I'm coming in beside them and saying that I too struggle with this issue and I understand what it's like. Also, practice your words. I find it very helpful to write out the first couple sentences as I sit down and talk with someone, especially because I've been doing this for years and I still don't like it a lot of times. It's not enjoyable to sit down with someone and bring up something that they're really struggling with, especially if I know they might not respond that well. And so if I have the first couple sentences scripted out, it gives me the confidence that I'm not just going to be stumbling over my words, or part of my problem is sometimes saying things that I really regret. And so kind of having a framework in mind can be really helpful. And part of that framework, too, is also imagining possible responses and being ready so you're not caught off guard. Especially since the person that we're talking about is somebody who you've been in group with sometimes for years, you probably know what they're going to tend towards, whether they're going to shut you down, whether they're just going to try to put you off. I suppose this is not a thing for guys as much, but girls will often start to cry, and you have to decide, am I going to take that as a genuine response or an attempt on their part to get me to stop talking about this? What if they get really angry? Do I back off? Do I move towards them? How do I handle this? So imagine possible responses. And if you're not sure how you come off in these conversations, just ask somebody that you trust. They'll tell you. You know, sometimes I think I'm being way too emotional and people are like, yeah, no, you barely express any emotion at all. So what's going on in my head does not match what's coming out of my mouth or what's going on my face or my body language. And so we're not always good gauges of how we're actually presenting ourselves. Now, what about the issue of anger? Is it appropriate to get angry? I do think that at times it is. And in Organic Disciple Making, they have an excellent section in their chapter on discerning resistance and how to work with resistant disciples that describes how to decide if you're going to use anger appropriately or not. What I'm concerned about in these conversations, though, is not that I'm going to use anger appropriately, but that I'm just going to come off kind of pissy and annoyed with the person. And there's a couple different reasons for that. One is maybe I'm just frustrated with them. God, I've been trying to help you for a while now and you're not changing, and I'm kind of sick of dealing with this. Or perhaps it's out of bitterness towards them for ways that they have affected me. Maybe it's bitterness in some other area of my life that's coming out on this person because they remind me of somebody else, or just because bitterness tends to spill over onto other people. Maybe it's an issue of my identity. I need this person to respond in a certain way in order to feel like an effective leader, and so I'm going to come in way too strong. Or maybe it's lack of boundaries, trying to force them to make the right decision. You know, I've especially seen this as I've tried to help people over the years with marriage choices. And I'm very grateful that a lot of my friends have made very, very wise marriage choices. But I have seen people make very unwise marriage choices. I've even seen people who, you know, they're dating somebody before they start walking, they come into the body of Christ, they start growing, but the person that they've been dating for a while is either not interested in walking or is not even a believer. And the person in our group is trying to convince themselves that this person really is a believer, and if we just get married, then they're going to start walking. You guys have seen some of this sometimes. And so you sit down and you have conversations with them, and you just feel like you are going to ruin your life if you marry this person. Now, I'm not always right on this, but sometimes I am, and I've seen it. And what I've had to remind myself in every single one of those conversations is, I love you, I want you to make a wise decision, but when it comes right down to it, it's your marriage, and it's your life. You're the one that's going to have to deal with these consequences, and not in a callous way, but in a very realistic way. No matter what you do, my marriage is going to be awesome, and I'm going to be really happy. So I hope you make the right decision, but that's not going to affect my life in a lot of ways. And sure enough, I've seen people end up in terrible situations, and you know what? My marriage is still really great. So it's helpful to have appropriate boundaries in place so that you let the adult people that you're working with make their own decisions, and you're not trying to force them to do something that they're not that interested in doing. And anger can also be a result of your own slowness. I suppose that's kind of related to frustration, that you just haven't brought it up soon enough, and you just kind of get sick of them, and you go in and you blast them. Again, you just need to get before the Lord and repent of that, and then try to move towards them in love. Because ultimately, what we're talking about is moving in with kindness. Are we being kind to our people? Do they know that we like them? Do they know that we're in their corner? Do they know that we accept them no matter what? Because of course, that's how God is towards us. You know, you think about 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient and love is kind. It's easy to overlook that kindness. It's helpful for me to remember how kind God is towards me. And isn't it really the kindness of God that leads towards repentance? And if you are kind with your people, then even when you bring in the heat, they will know it's because you really care about them and you want what's best for them. Because if you believe in people, you can call them to almost anything. And really, what it comes down to is the fact that polarization works. Moving into people's lives and trying to help them is going to help people more often than not. You know, there was a guy who came into our group many years ago, came from a really messed up family. He was super undisciplined. He had really slovenly personal habits. He couldn't pass classes to save his life. He was also really fearful of being the bad guy. So he was a really nice guy that everybody liked, but nobody in our group respected him. Nobody wanted to become like him. And so we moved into his life and we started bringing issues up. And it took many years, but you know, started working with him on getting good time with the Lord. And he grew in his discipline of connecting with God and became really consistent at it. We also talked to him about living a respectable life, losing weight, passing classes, being someone who was a servant around the house, actually getting his house chore done, things that he just was not doing in the beginning. And then we started working with him on speaking the truth in love, being willing to be unpopular for the sake of the gospel, you know, either with non-Christians or with people that he was living with and trying to work with. And there were a lot of setbacks. You know, he would try for a while and then he would kind of fail and we'd have to build it back up. Or another issue would come up in his life and he'd kind of see some reverses in some of the areas that he had made gains in. But what's really cool to see today is that he is a successful home church leader. And just as importantly, maybe even more importantly, he is a successful husband and father. And he is still a really nice guy, but he's a guy who is a powerful man of God who is now moving towards other people in a way that enables them to become more Christ-like. And so, yes, it took years, but was it worth it? It was totally worth it. And not just because he thanks us for it, but because we get to see him being used in the lives of other people. And so that's what I wanted to close on, was one final quote from Organic Discipleship, where they say, discipline in love is new to many Christian workers. It may seem counterintuitive, depending on your understanding of love. But when you take the time to study the Bible, reflect and pray deeply about your friend's problem, and take the courageous step of speaking the truth in love, you'll see God use you at new levels to change others' lives.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.